Lecture 8, Changing Language. Did the Normans really conquer English?
Hello, and welcome to the changing world of Old and Middle English. In this lecture, Lecture 8, we're going to look at some of the changes that were going on in Old English just at the time when the Normans were coming in to England in the 11th and 12th centuries. But what we're also going to do, I think, is try to disabuse ourselves of some myths or some presuppositions about the impact that the Norman conquest had on Old English. Now, when we think of the Norman conquest, we imagine a group of French-speaking aristocrats, rulers, ecclesiasts, and figures of military and social control who came to England and radically transformed Anglo-Saxon life. Our presuppositions of Anglo-Saxon life, too, need to change. In my previous lectures, I tried to illustrate some of the ways in which the Anglo-Saxon literary and cultural vocabulary was a highly textured one, a sense in which Old English poets and writers were giving new vernacular form to Latin Christian concepts, but also to older Germanic idioms of expression. Now, I had a colleague who once referred to what he called the Wagnerian school of Old English studies, our sense that the Anglo-Saxons were a group of mead-swilling, pike-toting figures out of some 19th century Wagner opera, and that, by contrast, the Normans were a group of remarkable sophisticates coming from the continent and transforming Anglo-Saxon England almost overnight, from an age of mead and pikes and horned helmets. We imagine all of a sudden, in 1066, people were eating champignons in a beurre blanc sauce. But of course, this did not happen. The impact and effect of the Norman conquest took centuries, but also Old English itself was changing, as it were, on its own. In this lecture, I would like to explore some of what we might call the natural changes in Old English, and ask the questions, did the Normans really conquer the English language? Now, when we look at English texts being written in the 11th and 12th centuries, we see a variety of changes going on apart from the impact of Norman French. In particular, Old English was changing dramatically from a highly inflected language to a relatively uninflected language. Things like noun case endings were being simplified or lost. Adjective endings, which were complicated in Old English, were being simplified or lost. Verb endings were simplified, and grammatical gender was lost. Now, the technical term to refer to this phenomenon, which we use to characterize this leveling out of forms, is syncretism. Syncretism is a term that describes the falling together of these old case endings or old inflectional endings into what we might call a leveling out, a general pronunciation of an undifferentiated "uh." Now, I'm going to spend some time in this lecture describing exactly how that happened and also talking about the written evidence for how that happened. But let me first give a few examples. What does it mean to say, for example, that the system of grammar or morphology was being simplified? Well, one of the things that's very interesting about Old English, like many of the Indo-European languages, is that its system of pronouns did not only have a singular and a plural, an I and a we, but it had what was called a dual. That is, it had a pronoun that specifically and uniquely referred to two people. Unker would have been the Old English pronoun for the two of us. This drops out during this period. and we're left with a system of pronouns that are just singular and plural. Let's talk about grammatical gender. You'll remember that grammatical gender in Old English, just as in other modern European languages, is a way of signaling certain kinds of noun classes, masculine, feminine, or neuter. And grammatical gender should not be confused with natural gender. A word like wife, woman, or wife in Old English was neuter in gender, even though it referred to a female individual. In Old English and in Early Middle English, as the language was changing, the pronoun that would be used to refer to a wife was hit, which is the old pronoun for it. Here, you had a word that signaled a female individual, but which was neuter in grammatical gender, and therefore required a pronoun that was also neuter. But what we see during this period from the 11th and 12th century to the early 13th century, the period in which Old English is changing from an inflected to an uninflected language, is that we see a word like weef being referred to not by a neuter pronoun, but by a feminine pronoun. Weef can now be a she and not just a hit or an it. Now, I think this is very important because this is the kind of specific grammatical evidence that indicates to us that a category such as grammatical gender is being lost. We move from grammatical gender to natural gender. Why did all of these things happen? Now, many theories have been proposed, and I want to just talk about a couple of them. Old English had a complicated inflectional system, but it also had a strong system of stress. Now, you'll remember from the last lecture, when I read Cadman's hymn, how the structure of Old English poetry is alliterative. Strong stresses on words are based on alliterative patterns. Mertet is mechte. And some scholars have argued that the strong stresses, not just in writing, but in speech, not just in poetry, but in everyday conversation, created an environment in which you stressed the root syllable of the word, and you came to stress less and less the ending of the word. What this suggests is that these words gradually came to be pronounced less and less precisely, perhaps, so that the endings of the words were not as audible as the main parts of the words. As these final endings became harder and harder to distinguish in speech and in listening, new grammatical functions had to develop for other parts of the language. For example, when you lose case endings, prepositions like to or on or after have to take greater prominence in order to sustain grammatical relationships. Patterns of word order become regularized, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes, so that English starts to move from a language in which the meaning of words in a sentence is determined by case endings to a language in which the meaning of words in a sentence is determined by the word order in the sentence. How do we know that this happened? What is our evidence for understanding these very technical and detailed moments of linguistic change? Written evidence, as I've said before, is a complicated kind of thing. What you want in written evidence is a level of literacy that's good enough actually to record sounds or forms, but isn't so high that what you're getting are conventions of writing almost irrespective of the sounds of the language. Spelling conventions, for example, or conventions of recording grammatical endings. But what you also want in your written evidence is precisely datable and localizable writing, We want to know where a text was written, when it was written, and ideally, who wrote it. Now, in the case of late Old English and early Middle English, we have a wonderful example in a text known as the Peterborough Chronicle. Now, let me just pause for a minute and explain a little bit about the Peterborough Chronicle. During the Anglo-Saxon period, monks and scribes and scholars kept histories in Old English prose, histories of the world, histories of events. And these histories are called annals because each entry usually begins with a year. You'll have the date, a given year, and then a phrase, in this year, such and such happened. And these entries can be highly complicated, paragraph after paragraph of detailed political and social commentary. Or they can be very short and aphoristic and cryptic. In this year, a great famine. In this year, a comet. The Peterborough Chronicle is the last sustained piece of Old English historical writing. It was carried on by the monks of Peterborough Abbey, a foundation in the Midlands in the central part of England, and it was kept apparently continuously until the year 1154. Now, this is almost a century after the Norman conquest, and there are people writing what, for all intents and purposes, is Old English prose. There are some French words that come in. There are some French expressions that come in. But because Peterborough was geographically removed from the initial site of French incursion, that is, it's in the Midlands rather than in the south or in the east, and because its monks sustained a historical and literary tradition, it gives us very good evidence for language change in action. Each entry is dated year by year. Now, we're not so sure that each entry was written in the given year. In fact, scholars have concluded that some of these entries were written retrospectively. That is, in a given year, a scribe would sit down and write a dozen or so years down. But what we can do with reasonable assurance is trace linguistic change through the Peterborough Chronicle. And this is what I'd like to do now in some detail. As I mentioned, each entry begins with a date and with the phrase, in this year. Now, in Old English, if you wanted to say in this year, you would use the phrase on visum iera. On is the Old English preposition, which means in or during. Visum iera, this year. The the UN ending in visum, and the E ending in iera indicate that these two words are in the dative masculine singular. In other words, iera is a masculine noun, grammatical gender. It's in the singular, there's one of them, and it's in the dative case because something's happening during it. The dative case is the case that's governed by this preposition on. So, in the year 1083, the scribe could write on visum iera. Perfect grammatical Old English, nearly two decades after the Norman conquest. Now let's take an entry from the year 1117. And the scribe begins that entry on this on iera. Now, the scribe has written not visum, but this on. The is on. O-N, not U-M. Why? Is the scribe illiterate? Is the scribe indicating a change in pronunciation? Is the scribe showing us that a case ending has changed? Perhaps what's going on, as some scholars have thought, is that, in fact, the case endings are becoming less and less audible. That English is moving from an inflected to an uninflected language, but the scribe still feels the need to record something like grammatical Old English. And what the scribe hears is just a kind of indiscriminate That is, a vowel of a certain kind followed by a consonant of a certain kind. You'll remember in my second lecture, I talked about articulatory phonetics as a method for understanding language structure and history. Well, what articulatory phonetics would say is that the ending has been leveled out to an indiscriminate back vowel, a vowel in the back of the mouth, and a nasal. A nasal is M or N, because the sound goes on the nose. So simply becomes on. Now let's go to 1135. On this yera. The ending has completely dropped out. And the E at the end of yera is still there, perhaps as a kind of fossil record of that earlier E. But grammatical gender, or what's called concord, that is, getting your adjective to agree grammatically with your noun, is gone. In 1154, the last dated entry of the Peterborough Chronicle, we simply have on this year. The case endings have dropped away, and for all intents and purposes, we're no longer in the world of inflected Old English. Now, I think that this is a fascinating example of how, in a very precise way, we can trace grammatical change. What are some of the other changes that are going on? One of the things that you can see in a work like the Peterborough Chronicle and in some of the other texts of the 11th and 12th centuries are changes in word order patterns. Now, what does this mean? Well, in Old and Early Middle English, word order became the marker for meaning. In other words, our modern English pattern, subject, verb, object. I love the girl. I read the book. This becomes, during this period, the standard pattern. But other patterns emerge, as it were, to do the work of meaning. So, for example, if you wanted to ask a question at this time, you would invert your word order. Instead of a subject and a verb, you would have a verb and a subject. Not you read the book, which is a statement, but read you the book, which is a question. Now, we can hear this still because certain things like the King James Bible or Shakespeare preserve this as a conscious archaism. It sounds like elevated language to us because it is archaic. We would not speak necessarily in this way, but this is how word order emerges as a way of understanding, as a way of making meaning in certain kinds of patterns. But you could also invert word order for intensive purposes. Now you would invert not the subject and the verb, but the verb and the object. I beseech you. That's sort of neutral. I, you, beseech, that's intensive. That's, I'm really beseeching you. And this inversion of word order pattern really emerges during this period as a way of indicating stress or intention. But there were other word order patterns from Old English that really do survive, and in fact that survive well into the age of Shakespeare. One of these is what's called passive reflexive. Methinketh. This is methinks. Now, methinks does not mean I think. It means it seems to me. You liketh is not a kind of imagined, ungrammatical way of do you like something, but it pleases you. These patterns are from Old English and they survive all the way until the Renaissance. So while some patterns are changing, some patterns are staying the same. Certain patterns of pronunciation are also changing. For example, Old English had a very complicated set of consonant sounds. Now, you'll remember when I read Cadman's hymn that we could hear Old English in very special ways. The sound of Old English is quite distinctive. If you listen to certain clusters of consonants, you can hear almost a kind of onomatopoetics of the language. Old English had consonant clusters like H-L at the beginning of a word. Now just try pronouncing a word beginning with H-L. Try saying a word like chlachian, which is the Old English word for laugh. Or try saying something like H-R, hring, which is the Old English word for ring. Or try saying something like H-N. Try saying chnehan, which is the Old English word for neigh, the sound a horse makes. Now, during this period, in the 11th and the 12th and the early 13th centuries, these consonant clusters are similarly being reduced. And so instead of saying chlachian, you say laugh. Instead of saying ring, you say ring. And instead of saying chnay, you say nay. Similarly, Old English had a consonant cluster, fn. Now, the fn consonant cluster was the sound that was used to indicate, how can I put this? It was the sound that was used to indicate nasality in the large. Fnasnyan, fnortnyan. Those are the Old English words for sneeze and snort. A horse fnasts, or someone gnorts, snorts. Now, these sounds became SN, sneeze and snort, during the period. And finally, another distinctive Old English consonant cluster that contributes to the sound of the language is HW, Beowulf, the great Old English epic, written down in about the year 1000, but possibly composed centuries before, begins with a call to attention. Huat wegardena in gerdagum. The first word is huat, which is really our word what, but it's really more like let me have your attention, or listen. I had a teacher who once described the word huat as meaning something to the effect of, I suppose you're wondering why I've called you all here today. This sound becomes WH. Huat, hua, which become what, who, and which. Other sounds are changing. Let's look at a word like our word Lord. Our word Lord is just kind of a compressed version of an Old English word chlaford. Chla becomes la. Chlaf is the Old English word for loaf, a loaf of bread. Chlaford is, in fact, nothing more than a compressed version of chlafward. Remember from Cadman's hymn, Waird, the warden, the guardian. The Lord was the chlaf weord, the guardian of the loaves, imagining that sort of military and social control was based on doling out something like bread. Chlavord, lavord, lord. That kind of coming together is what's happening during this period as well. I've mentioned metathesis earlier in this series of lectures. During the period, certain words, as it were, permanently metathesize. And so Old English words like axe become ask. A word like brid becomes bird. A word like thurch becomes through. And a word like Beorcht becomes bright. These are sound changes that we can see during our own lives, but they are also changes which happen historically. And in this case, a series of metatheses happened at a very special time, and they changed permanently the way in which we pronounce our language. Let me just offer a few other examples. I've talked about strong verbs and weak verbs. You remember, strong verbs are those verbs that indicate change in tense for the meaningful change of the root vowel. And weak verbs are words that indicate change in tense by adding a suffix. Talk, talked is weak. Run, ran is strong. What's happening also at this time is that some of the old strong verbs are changing into weak verbs. A word like need, help, wax, these are strong verbs, but they are gradually transforming themselves into weak verbs. These are not isolated incidents. What I'm talking about in general here are not just individual changes in grammar or morphology, or changes in pronunciation, or changes in the individual way in which certain words are sounded or function. I'm talking about larger systematic changes. The system of making meaning in the language is changing over time. These changes, I am suggesting, are going on while the Norman conquest is inflecting and texturing Old English with newer French forms and newer French words. In the next lecture, I'm going to be detailing some of the ways in which Norman French changes English, the way in which it adds vocabulary, the way in which it also affects pronunciation and patterns of stress. But I think what I would like to do as a way of moving transitionally to that lecture is think now not just about grammar, but about literature. One of the things I've tried to do in this course of lectures and will continue to do is illustrate linguistic change through literary allusion. About the year 1200, a whole set of poems are being written that indicate for us these changes. One of the most beautiful and exquisite of these poems is known as The Owl and the Nightingale, a poem to which I will refer in my next lecture. Let me just say a little bit about that now as a bridge. The Owl and the Nightingale, probably composed the late 12th century, written down in the early 13th century, is a story of an individual who listens to a debate between a speaking owl and a speaking nightingale. And the owl in this poem is representative of sobriety, intellection, and control. And the nightingale is representative of beauty, of lyric, of love. It's a beautiful and exquisite poem, and as you read through it, or if you were to listen to it, you'd recognize that the nightingale progressively sounds more and more French than the owl. And some could even argue that this is a poem not just about two ways of life, but about two languages and two cultures. And the poem begins, "Ich was in ona sumra dala, in ona sudha dihala hala." I found myself, I was, in a shady nook, in a certain hidden place. "Ich was in ona sumra dala, in ona sudha dihala hala." Every word in that couplet I've just recited is an Old English word. Yet, just listen to the sound. This is a poem which is now in rhymed couplets, a poem in octosyllabic meter, that is, eight syllables, four stresses, iambic verse. It sounds like continental poetry. Its structure is the structure of French verse. But every single word in that couplet is English. It's an English landscape, an English nook, an English dale, into which a French pattern of poetry has come in. What we're going to see in the next lecture is, in effect, the narrative behind that little literary innovation. How does the English landscape change under French domination? How does the English language shift under the pressure of the Norman conquest? Thank you.